Hi, I'm Rochelle Jackson, and this is The Crime Couch. I'm an investigative journalist and true crime author, and I know who's who in the zoo, the crims, the cops, and the interesting individuals in between. So get comfy and join me here on The Crime Couch. It's going to be one heck of a journey. This is part one of a two-part chat on The Crime Couch with Sonia Leading. The 29th of May 2011 is a date that changed Queensland Police Detective Sonia Leading's world forever. This was the night her husband Damien, also a Queensland Detective Senior Constable, was shot and killed during a botched armed robbery. Since that fateful night, Sonia's life, of course, has never been the same. The Detective Senior Constable's written a book, Blue Widow, by Ocean Reeve Publishing. Blue Widow is a ballsy, extremely candid and brilliant read about what Sonia endured. It includes her failed relationships, wrestle with the booze, and how she coped with the grief and eventually came to terms with what happened that night. Hi, Sonia, and a big warm welcome to The Crime Couch.
Thank you, Rochelle. Thank you for having me here.
Sonia, why did you join the job?
Well, back then, it was something that I'd always wanted to do, even though it was diverted slightly after university. But at 15, I decided that I wanted to be a detective. At that time, it was called the JAB, the Juvenile Aid Bureau. And that's where I needed to be. I needed to be helping children victims and other vulnerable victims. So slightly deviated, went on to become a lawyer, and then went, actually, no, I'm going to go back and be a cop. It was what I really wanted to do. I needed to serve.
And what resonated with you about child victims? Because that's quite fascinating at such a young age.
Look, I think at the time I'd had a few experiences myself with some detectives. And then I listened to a detective at school, and she came into our legal studies class and told us all about the things that she does in child protection. And initially I thought, oh, maybe I'm, you know, not strong enough to do that. And I sort of sat there for years thinking, maybe I will, maybe I won't. And eventually it all came to fruition in about 2017 when I decided that that was where I needed to be.
How did you first meet your husband, Damien, aka Damo? And of course, every police member has a nickname.
Absolutely. Damo, the Ranger. I could go on with a whole heap of others. They're a bit derogatory, though. Look, we first saw each other at the academy, but we didn't actually speak then. And it wasn't until I was working at Southport Station in our first year, where we started sledging each other off across the day room, that we became mates. And eventually he moved into the spare room of my flat, and I guess the rest is history after that.
How would you describe your relationship and the love that you have and still have for Damo?
Oh, look, it was a slow burner to start with, and people that knew him before I did said, nah, son, once he was with you, that was it. Once he knew he wanted you, he didn't look at anyone else. And I was like, oh, yeah, it's just my flatmate, whatever. The annoying ranger, he'd just come in and we were best mates. Like, we did everything together. We'd go down to the local ice cream shop in our thongs and our socks in the middle of winter, and we'd just do stupid stuff together. And it was pretty simple, really, at the end of the day. I guess our love kind of started slowly, and then once we knew that we wanted to be together, that was it. Like, no one else got a look in.
And that's the best sort of a relationship, isn't it, where, you know, you're each other's best friends?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's something, I suppose, that I've craved since then. You know, I've lost my best mate. I've lost that person that I share everything with. And despite having female friends and my parents around, it's just not quite the same.
You've lost your compass.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I did. I did for a really long time. I had no idea which way I was going. And he was always the person that brought me back down to earth when I needed to be brought down. But, he was it.
What sort of a cop was Damien?
So I guess I can explain it this way. He'd go running, and when Damon would go running, it wasn't for 40 minutes for like a 6K run or whatever, like that was my time. He'd go for 2 hours. So he'd go running and I go, "Where are you going?" He goes, "I'm just going for a run." "Well, how long are you going to be?" "Oh, a couple of hours." "How many Ks should I sort of expect the radius to be from home?" He goes, "Oh, I don't know, maybe like 25, 30 Ks. And I'd be like, "Righto." And then he'd come home and he'd go, "Oh, I saw so-and-so," one of my local clients, or his local clients, should I say. And he'd go, "I've just got to jump in the car. I've just got to do this drive-by of this house." I'm like, "Babe, you're not working." And he'd go, "Yeah, yeah, I'll be back in a few minutes." And he'd come back and then he'd be ringing the office to relay the intel. So I suppose for him it never stopped because we lived and worked in the same area he did. And he was absolutely tenacious with getting the druggies. Like, there were times when I would be sitting at home and he'd be getting phone calls from one of his informants. And they'd be like, "Yeah, yeah, mate, we've just got this shipment of glassware." And Damo would go, "Babe, got to go to work." I'm like, "What do you mean? Does no one else in your office do any work? You've got to go to work. We've just, like, we've got a baby and your family's at home and you're going to work." He goes, "Don't worry, it'll end soon. We'll be right." So I guess he was married to the job and me at the same time, but he absolutely loved it. Like, he loved it. He didn't stop at anything to get the crooks.
And without doubt, having read your excellent book, Blue Widow, he obviously adored you.
Yeah, he did. He was pretty quiet about it, I guess, and he did things in quiet ways. You know, like, we spent a lot of family time together when we could, when he wasn't working and chasing informants. And we'd just do quiet stuff. There was nothing, no big verbose shows of his love. It was just the little things, you know, the coffee in the morning, or as I'd walk past, he'd pat me on the bum and say, "Looking good," or something like that. It was just those little things. And I suppose that's what I miss the most, is the small stuff. It's not even the big stuff, because that kind of thing, you can, you know, you can create that, but you can't create the small stuff.
It's the little things and those little sorts of, it's almost like consideration for you too, isn't it? And kind of reinforcement of that love.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess for him, he was a busy guy at work. And once we had the kids, it was, everything kind of came full circle. So, you know, we'd done what we needed to do. We had our pigeon pair, a boy and a girl, and he was made. Like, I didn't think that having children for him would be a big thing, but it was just massive. Literally, as soon as we got together, he was pushing me to have a baby. And I'm like, hey, I'm 24. I've still got too much partying in me. I need to go out and have drinks and go dancing and do all the fun stuff. And he was like, no, I'm ready for this. And I'm like, you're only a couple of years older than me. Like, we just got together. Can't we, you know, do the dating thing for a while before we do that? So, yeah, that was Damo.
He sounds incredible, Sonia. How do you now recall that night when Damien was shot and killed?
Now it's pretty clear. I can still see and hear the knocks on the door, you know, being woken to someone knocking at your door just after midnight is pretty horrific, because you're thinking, well, what's going on? Why is somebody knocking on my door? And then to see a police officer in full formal uniform, which can only mean bad news. Yeah, it still gets me. I often talk about it and people think, oh, they sort of say, you can see this graphically. I said, yeah, I can. I can see it like I'm sitting back watching it happen again every single time. And that same sick feeling replays, and, you know, seeing me standing there in my pajamas with my mag torch, shining it through the glass on the side of the door, going, nope, I'm not opening it. I'm just not opening it. If I don't open it, that bad can't come in here. So it's still very much there, despite being now just over 12 years since it happened. I suppose it now has a place in that story. So it's not something that replays in my head often.
I think the thing that really struck me is that how on earth can anyone, police member or civilian, ever prepare themselves for that knock on the door and the knowledge that your loved one has been killed and murdered. I mean, there's no, even though police members deal with death every day and deal with a lot of death and a lot of bodies and a lot of death knocks, when it's your own, it's completely different.
Yeah, absolutely. And you want it to stop. It's, I guess, the minute you open that door, it's real. And if you keep that door closed and run away, then perhaps it's not. And that's what I would have loved to have done. But the reality is, you know, I've done it from both sides. So I've done it as the victim, I suppose, for want of a better word, and I don't like using that word. And I've done it as the police officer, where you see the look on the face and the people look at you and you're in full uniform and you're like, yep, the only reason police are here at some ridiculous hour of the night is to give me bad news. It's just how it is. It is like it is in the movies. I can vouch for that.
And it's also ridiculously surreal. I know from experiencing my father's death 6 months ago, it doesn't matter, even if someone is of an age and experience and death, you know, is never too far away, you never expect it. And it's very surreal, isn't it?
Absolutely. Especially when someone's telling you your husband went to work and now they've been shot. And I guess the fact is that neither of us had ever spoken about any of that kind of thing happening. Neither of us had any concerns whatsoever about one of us going to work and not coming home. It was just a given we were going to come home. You know, I guess you don't join the job and go, hang on, I'm going to be worried about this, because if you did that, you wouldn't get out of bed. You wouldn't go to any jobs. You wouldn't put your uniform on and do what we do. So for us, it was just luck of the draw, unfortunately.
Well, Sonia, I've really got to congratulate you on your book, Blue Widow. It is gutsy, it's raw, it's incredibly engaging. I could really hear the voice of every single police female member that I've ever met and interviewed and I'm good mates with. Despite what you went through, it was obvious that you really wanted to deal with Damien's murder in your own way, despite what command wanted. Was this just an automatic response from you?
I suppose it was, and the fact that I've always been someone to do things a little bit differently. Like often my friends say, you make a decision and you don't even talk to us. And I go, well, why would I? I've already made my mind up. You know, and when I'm sitting down with our commissioner going, well, why do we have to have a state funeral? Like I just want a family funeral, because Damien was a husband and a father and a friend and, you know, he was a human being. He's not just a cop. And to have the commissioner sort of look at me and go, why wouldn't you have a state funeral? He's a hero. And I'm like, yes, but he's that human in the uniform as well. I think it's just such a, I don't know. It was, for me, it was just one of those things. And I went, nope, I'm going to buck the system as much as I can, just because they were telling me I had to do something that I didn't want to do.
It's also so much about the police service, even with all the best intentions, it's often about the optics and what it looks like. Yeah. And you're kind of going, well, hold on, he's my husband, he's my lover, he's the father of my two children. Yeah. It must have just been so surreal. I can't even, and you've really articulated it in this book, just the whirlwind and the huge emotional roller coaster you've been on.
Absolutely. Like from day one, it was hectic. It was something, like I say to people, it was like watching that family on the news when we were the family. And, you know, you sit there and you're sympathetic, but you don't know what they're going through. And then when we're going through it, I'm like, oh, this is what this is like. And it's awful and it's heavy and there's lots of official things to do. And that's nobody's fault. It just is what it is. It's part of the protocol. And for me, I was thinking, well, okay, if we have to do protocol, I'm going to put my own stamp on it. You want songs? We're going to have songs at the funeral. You know, you want this? We're going to have all of these photos. We're not just having five that keep playing on rotation. You know, they had to cut down the photo montage and all of those sorts of things. But I went, well, if this is his last hurrah, it's going to be done my way, despite having to do it your way.
Sonia, in your book, you do reveal, as I mentioned, that horrific roller coaster that you were on trying to cope with what happened. As I mentioned, I lost my father 6 months ago and I deal with his loss every day still. But how do you deal with the sudden, unexpected, violent death of your loved one and your soulmate?
Oh, look, it's 12 years on now, and I did a presentation this morning and they asked the same thing. Does the grief get any better? And I'm like, well, it changes. It's not better or worse, but it changes and it evolves. And with time, obviously, your feelings are quite different around those events. It doesn't hurt any less, and it doesn't mean that that peace is ever coming back, but it's just something that you have to walk through. And I don't think I can sit here and say, oh, it needs to be done a certain way. I know there were people in the beginning who said, oh, well, look, you need to speak to this person because her husband died and this happened. And I'm like, yeah, but this is my husband. Why would I need to speak to them? I don't want someone telling me how to grieve. So for me, it was a really personal battle, and I was very determined to do it my way and not do it anyone else's way and navigate my own way through it, whether that was right or wrong. And yes, it was a roller coaster. I constantly felt like I was sitting at the top waiting for the brakes to be let go of, not knowing where it was going to go next and not knowing if it was going to be good or bad.
That's really clear in your book. You also describe, Sonia, your ongoing wrestle with alcohol. It really struck me because, you know, I've done a lot of interviews with a lot of police members. Often they turn to booze. Yep. Why do you think that is? Why do you think it's a go-to for a lot of police members?
Look, I think, and I was only thinking about it not long ago, the simple fact that the minute I have a glass of wine, my brain stops. It literally switches everything off. And I think, oh, I can relax. Whereas without it, and I've got much better at managing it, all these different tabs are open and I've got to do this and I've got to do that. Whereas the minute I have a couple of glasses, I'm like, oh, that can wait till the next day. Don't worry about it. We're not doing it tonight. Mummy's having wine. Like, that's how it was. And the same thing with grieving is the minute I woke up the day that we got home and saw empty glasses all over my bench, I went, they've had champagne without me? Where's mine? How am I going to deal with this without it? Like, I feel horrible. I want to feel better. Give me the wine. Like, give me the wine.
I think, is that something that you still struggle with, Sonia?
Yeah, absolutely. It's, at the moment, I'm doing a gym challenge, so it's been pretty good the last few weeks. I know there are days when I get home from work and I think, all I want is a glass of wine. I need to switch this off. Like, depending on what jobs I've been on and depending how busy we are, I come in and I'm thinking, well, I've got to do mum mode now and I need to do all these things, but I need it to slow down. So I think, oh, cool, glass of wine, that'll fix it. But it's not just the glass. I'll go and have the whole bottle, you know, I won't stop at one. So I'm very aware of that, and it's something that I feel like I manage better now, dependent on obviously what happens at work and what's happening at home and what triggers are around, and it's a constant battle. But I do feel when it gets away from me, and I know that I've been having too much because I don't sleep, I don't eat properly, I don't function properly. I still go to the gym, but I get nothing out of my workouts, you know, so nothing works properly. When I'm having dinner with the kids and I've had too much wine, my patience is less, far less, and I'm like, righto, can you guys hurry up because I need to clean up. So yeah, it's a constant battle and something that, you know, I think was going to be something lifelong that I'll have to work on.
And I think it's also probably, it sounds to me like as soon as you have the wine, that's what you equate with relaxing and turning off.
Oh, 100%. Yep. It's like, and you know, my girlfriends that I work with, when are we having wine? We need to go out for a wine or a cocktail. And I'm like, I won't say it's a police culture. Well, it probably is, but it's how you socialise. How do you socialise without wine? You know, and I guess learning to do that is a big thing.
Well, it's not just a police member. Everyone does it. We all do it. So how else, Sonia, did you deal with the loss of Damien? Like, what did you lean on and what were your supports?
My parents have been the absolute godsend. I think without them, if they weren't around, I probably wouldn't be either. They've been my second set of hands with the kids, and they're just, I think they keep me accountable. So, you know, I might be having a bad week or whatever it might be, but they will always show up for me. They will always step in where I literally can't. And they know that, you know, they know, they'll keep an eye on me and they go, yep, cool, she's not functioning this week, so we'll just step it up. I don't even have to ask. Probably not so much these days, but in the early days, I just checked out. I didn't want to be there. And so they were a massive support. The rest of my family, my brother and my two sisters as well, and their families have been amazing. We're all very close. So I'm very fortunate that I've had those right people around me. I've got a really good group of friends too. I mean, I could talk about them all day, all these different personalities, but each one of them brings something different to the table and something different that I need at different times during, you know, that support period. So yeah, it's a village.
Of course. And Trudy, your best friend, also sounds like you write about her in the book, and she sounds like she's a real compass for you and a touchstone.
100%. She is. I probably didn't realise how much until she moved out to Mount Isa in July this year. And both of us keep saying it, that even though we used to live up the road from each other, we didn't see each other much, but at least I could pop in and see her at work, or she'd pop in and see me, and it would be a quick debrief and we'd be right. Whereas now we kind of have to time our FaceTime chats or phone calls to fit in. And she says the other day, she says, oh, you know, you can ring me whenever. And I'm like, yeah, but you actually really like your job out there. You don't have time to talk to me when you're working anymore. So, you know, Trude's, at the end of the day, she's always in the background, and she always says to me, you know, I'm not a big public person. Sorry, we're talking about you now. And she does. She hangs around in the background, and people know that she's there. And a lot of people sort of wondered how on earth we got along, and I did too in the beginning, but we're the best of mates, and, you know, you can't separate us.
Tune in next time on The Crime Couch when we feature part two of this chat with Sonia Leading. Thanks for joining me. I'm Rochelle Jackson, and I look forward to your company next time on The Crime Couch.